Part 6 of 6 from set number 1009, a supplement to C.G. Jung's 7 Sermons to the Dead, a BC Recordings copyrighted presentation by Stefan Heller entitled Why and Wherefore of Gnostic Gems.
It is no doubt known to most of you, if not all of you, that our old spiritual ancestors and friends, the Gnostics of the first 3 or 4 centuries AD, had left behind in various places quite a large number of amuletic, talismanic objects, most of them in the forms of carved gems, some of them on metal. In fact, as in one of our exhibits last week was on metal, and that indeed for quite a long time these objects were perhaps some of the principal reminders that people had of the Gnostics. As various scholars have pointed out, the Gnostic literature, the Gnostic Bibles, Gnostic Gospels, and so forth have in short order been destroyed at the end of the 3rd century, the early part of the 4th century, and really the largest number of the original scriptures only being discovered in the middle of this last 20th century. So there were very few things available from the Gnostics for a long, long time, but what was certainly available were these curious objects, which have been the subject of interest. I understand that, for instance, at the time of the Renaissance, in the 1400s, 1500s, 1600s, when the interest in ancient learning, in the Greco-Roman art and wisdom was once again stimulated in Europe, then the Gnostic gems were quite a bit sought after too. I also understand that in the 19th century, especially after some of the revival of interest again in ancient matters, especially of ancient magic, as the result of the writings of Eliphas Levi, in the middle of the 19th century, in France particularly, there were even reproductions made of some of the ancient Gnostic materials. And some of those are around too, but of course they are discernible from the ancient things. And so in and there have been in the 18th century, even in the 17th century, 18th century, 19th century, there were various books published by people who had collected these and who had commented on them. The most famous, which I mentioned last time, and I'm not going to go into any detail, was in 1864, the noted book called The Gnostics and Their Remains, which, as I always feel, really should have been written by an undertaker, remains, by C.W. King, which became a major source of information, however, not only about what Dr. King called the Abraxoids, which means Abraxas-like objects, but really also about the teachings and the orientation of the Gnostics themselves. King, of course, was an early scholar, a reputable scholar, had very little information available to him, and so much of his material now is dated, but it is filled with designs, reproductions, line drawings of these Gnostic gems, and for that reason is still a very important source book. I don't have it with me tonight, but it was republished, of all places, here in San Diego some years ago by a little publishing company, and still available, The Gnostics and Their Remains. And especially the images there, I think it are probably more profuse and clearer than in any other book. You might want to take a look at that. Then we spent a little time on defining what talismans and amulets are, and we said that the Oxford English Dictionary definition of a talisman, which the definition isn't all that terribly helpful, is that it is an object engraven with figures or characters to which are attributed the occult powers of the planetary influences and celestial configurations under which they are made. Well, that's a very limited definition. The origin of the word talisman is telesma. It's Greek, meaning a blessed or consecrated, a sacred object. The other related term, amulet, comes from the Latin amuletum, which is defined as something worn about a person as a charm or a preventive against evil, mischief, disease, witchcraft, and so forth. All of these definitions are a little bit inadequate for our purposes, although not totally so. They concentrate on the negative value, which is no doubt present, namely the preventative value as a protection against this, that, and the other thing. And that, of course, is also true. We have a bit of a compliment going on. One wonders how it would be if these sirens would play, say, Beethoven or something like that. Wouldn't it be a... But then, of course, people would object and said, no, we want to hear another piece of music. But it would be a welcome change. Certainly that is present in most cases, but there is really one that is probably for our purposes far more important than any other, and that is the one that I have explicated to some extent before and will do so now again, that objects of this sort exist for the purpose of linking the individual by way of a symbol with the powers symbolized. And I think the nature and the power of symbols has been explored in the latter part of the 20th century more meaningfully than it has been for a long time prior to that time, because I think we have found out, as the result of the researches of mythologists, psychologists such as C.G. Jung and others, that there is really something to a symbol that is much more than a mere sign. That a symbol is not just something that signifies something else. That we cannot say, well, here is the symbol and it equals such and such. But that symbol is a mysterious and powerful thing in itself, which acts as, I think Henri Corbin pointed out, as a cipher to a mystery, a key that unlocks something greater, a way that may be employed by the mind to enter, to some degree, a reality other than the one wherein we live. Now, this may sound very mysterious and indeed very magical, but then isn't that exactly what these things are supposed to be, magical? I think we have discovered in this, to say the least, rather ambivalent century that we have just slithered out of, it is indeed true that authentic symbols have a capacity to speak directly to the deeper strata of the mind and to unlock certain powers of perception and insight which can cause important and transformative expansions of consciousness. These are all, I think, considerations that the far more prosaic and rationalistic way in which people observed symbols earlier were not capable of discovering. So we know now that where we are dealing with authentic symbolism, we are really dealing with something that is quite powerful and quite useful, but in an internal, in a mental sense. And of course, this is how sacred symbolic art has always been used. In the Eastern Orthodox Christian tradition, for instance, the icons, and iconium really means a picture, an image. The Eastern Orthodox did not employ statuary or relief statuary in the churches for sacred purposes, for reasons of their own. I think originally perhaps because there was too much like the sacred art of the pagans, but they certainly specialized in sacred imagery in the form of painting. And these paintings or icons, were traditionally referred to as windows into heaven. And so they are, because they are much more than representational, but owing to their symbolic and sacred geometrical structure, they are capable of inducing certain expanded states of consciousness when they are treated with devotion, with reverence. So this idea of the symbol being an opener to something deeper is certainly present in many places and is, I think, now well attested to in various ways. It has also been suggested, and I'll say a little more about that, that the Gnostic gems, the Gnostic amulets, may have served as signs of recognition among the people, that if you walked around the streets of Alexandria and you had an Abraxas dangling from your neck, then other Gnostics would recognize you as a fellow Gnostic. Not very convincing. Now, we also need to keep in mind, and again I have to beg the indulgence of those who were here last time, because these things I have mentioned, although I'm summarizing them now, that of course mystico-magical jewelry has existed for a long time, and it was particularly in vogue in the Roman Empire. The Romans did not use jewelry, so it would seem, primarily, or certainly not exclusively, for ornamental purposes. But the practical people that they were, they tried to combine the ornamental function and value of jewelry with the magical, mystical properties of the jewelry. And so, first of all, the stones themselves often had valuations of certain magical properties. From a certain time on, the certain gemstones came to be associated with the planets. Later on, when Kabbalah came into vogue, especially during the Renaissance, then the stones came to be associated with the Sephiroth on the Tree of Life. But much earlier than that, in the Greco-Roman world already, the various stones were considered to have magical properties. For instance, I wear an amethyst here, and amethyst in Greek means don't be poisoned. And so amethysts were worn as a protection against poisons, including the toxic properties of alcohol. And so it was believed that if you have enough amethysts with you, you are not going to get drunk. And people would put amethyst crystals into their cups when they were drinking, and they drank it through that, and it's supposed to absorb poisons, including the toxic properties of alcohol. I have found it to be very effective, but only when it is combined with very moderate drinking. If the volume of the alcohol consumed becomes excessive, the amethyst doesn't work all that well. Gnostic talismans don't seem to be based on the nature of the stones. There is a different situation here. They are based on the design carried in the stone. Somewhat like signet rings, which you may know something about, wherein particularly in European family traditions, people would wear the emblem of their family, the coat of arms, on their rings, again in intaglio, in a stone or in gold, in continental jewelry usually in a stone, in England usually in gold or silver, and then these could be used to be pressed into warm, heated up sealing wax to bear your seal on a letter or things of that sort. The important thing is the design. Now, I will not repeat the material of the Gnostic talismanic stones. Let's just say that when one analyzes a sufficient number of these stones that have been found, it would seem that they were primarily used because of the ability of the stone to take nice engraving, that they had the requisite qualities for good engraving. And as we saw last week, while certainly there are some stones of that period and of the Gnostic stones that have a relatively primitive carving, such is certainly not generally the case, and we had some examples here, and we have the pictures of them, of extremely sophisticated and artistically very, very effective carving. They are not usually very large. The majority of the ones that are around are fairly small, but there are also quite large ones, and we had probably some of the largest ones in captivity here with us last time, and we had them photographed. The workmanship varies. It has also been noted. In fact, it has been noted by some of you, or at least by some who were here, who told me, you see, the more eyes look at something, the more they see. That's an old story, and a very good one at that, that there seemed to have been quite a discrepancy in some of the stones that we had here. For instance, that really large, dark one that had the magnificent Abraxas in it and a lot of writing on the... the carving of the figure was extremely sophisticated, while the writing seemed to have had a rather primitive carving, as if it were done by two different people. And from this I conclude that at least the likelihood exists that perhaps people would have a stone carved or buy one from a stone carver, and then they wrote the magic words, the magical formulae, the letters in themselves. So that is probably the greatest likelihood in terms of a reason for that. Now, as I already indicated very briefly, I feel rather strongly that the principal purpose of the Gnostic gems was indeed of a symbolic nature, that they existed in order to link the wearer with the transcendental principles, archetypal powers and beings, by way of the inscribed magical words, which are always there, sometimes very few and sometimes a good many. The amulets may have even served as sorts of reminders of prayers and invocations, rather like in Christendom, and I think in Islam also. They may have even existed in Islam first. People use rosaries, beads, for the purpose of reminding them of the certain numbers of prayers and so forth, an aid in prayer And so it is certainly very possible and indeed likely that certain formulae would be inscribed on these stones, and then people would take them and look at them, and it would remind them of the prayers which they had no doubt memorized already, but that this would serve as a mnemonic device. Now, of course, as certainly all of those who were here remember, when we were trying to decipher some of these inscriptions, that the inscriptions are almost uniformly of a certain nature and a certain character that is rather puzzling to people today. Because with very, very few exceptions, the inscriptions on the stones are not in any known language, at least not in a language known to us. Now, from a contemporary and rationalistic point of view, we'd see why in all tarnation would someone take the trouble of carve all these things into a stone when they, quote, don't mean anything. Now, here we need to keep in mind that just because something is not in a known language does not mean that it doesn't mean anything. And so what these inscriptions consisted of primarily are what came to be called by the scholars, maybe somewhat misleadingly, the barbarous words, which are primarily vowel sounds in various combinations, and which quite obviously were used for chanting. And in being chanted, they were expected to produce certain results in the mind, in the perception of the individual, and bring about perhaps a relationship and a communication with deeper powers. In fact, that's one, at least one area where I think C.W. King back there in the 19th century was on the right track. He, of course, that was a time when people, especially the British, were rather excited about India. They had India for some time, and they were exploring Indian things, and so they began to understand some things about India. So he even theorized that the Gnostics must somehow have learned some of their wisdom from India, which really is not believed by scholarship today. But there is a similarity. And what is that similarity? That similarity is that of words of power, of what are called in the East by Hindus and Buddhists mantras. And the effect of a mantra is not its intellectual meaning. It may or may not have a meaning. The famous Sanskrit mantra of the Buddhists, Om Mani Padme Hum, used very extensively in Tibetan Buddhism, does have a meaning. It means Om, the jewel in the lotus. But it doesn't really have an intellectual meaning. People who say that have neither lotuses in front of them nor jewels in front of them. It has a metaphorical meaning, and it has a meaning in sound, which is the main idea, say, with mantras. So the famous mantra Om, which is used both, as we have just seen, both by Hindus and Buddhists, again, it doesn't have an intellectual meaning. You can theorize about it, but it is the sound, in Sanskrit called Vak, which is like the logos in the West, the creative sound that matters. And so the many so-called barbarous words, barbarous meaning being a Greek term for something that one doesn't understand. The reason that the Greeks called other people barbarians was because they didn't understand their speech, and it all sounded to them bar, 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 as they were. So they said they are the barbarians. anybody who's not a Greek is a barbarian. I remember Her Late Majesty Queen Frederica of Greece, who was here in Los Angeles in the 1950s, I think, and she gave a speech, and she was a German, you know, by birth, and she very humbly said, you know, I must admit that I also was born a barbarian, because she was not born a Greek. So that is the meaning of barbarous words. There is another interesting idea about some of these formulae, and I'll read some of them to you later again for those who aren't here. It has occurred to scholars that these sounds, and perhaps mantras in general, weren't just, devised by people in their conscious minds, but that perhaps at first they were heard with the inner ear in non-ordinary states of consciousness, in deep meditation, in ecstasy, and then written down, which is after all quite possible. Maybe on a somewhat more primitive level, after all, we have even in our own days the phenomena which in more elegant language are called glossolalia, and in less elegant language are called speaking in tongues. Some of which is, I'm sorry to say, to me appears kind of, weird. But on the other hand, the principle, I think, matters, that people are sometimes inspired to utter or to verbalize sounds that somehow come to them from within, and that these sounds have a function. The principle being that when something powerful like that comes from within, whatever the within may be, and you are able to get hold of it, by reciting it, you may go back within again. It came from within, and by saying it, you go back within. You see the connection. And so this is also quite likely. Alright, now we are moving more into the newer material. The majority of the Gnostic gems have a particular figure on it. And this figure is identified often, the name being written there, and it's also, let's say, identified because we know what that figure looks like, a Gnostic mystical figure called Abraxas or Abrasax. Now, the S and the, what we call an S and an X, which would be the capital sigma and the capital chi in Greek, are in sound very similar. And they are also, when written in capital letters, as most of these things are written in capital letters, in all the inscriptions on the gems last time, we only saw one little bitty passage that was in lower key Greek letters. The rest of it is all in capital letters, which is a problem to me because I remember the lower key Greek better than the capital letters. But the way a capital sigma and a capital chi are written is rather similar. And so there is kind of an argument as to whether it's Abrasax or whether it's Abraxas. The earlier translation in the earlier books have always been Abraxas, while now in the more recent books it's usually translated or transliterated into our kind of alphabet as Abrasax. But I'm sure it does not mean a great deal. Now, old Abraxas, and later on when you are moving about the room, we have a number of depictions on our wall you can take a look at, is a mythological figure which in all of its depictions has very similar features. It has the head of a bird. The bird is most frequently a rooster, and a little bit less frequently a hawk, the hawk being a long sacred symbol in Egypt, since it was the sacred symbol of Horus, the son of the god, the son of Osiris, the fighting hawk. And hawks are very archetypal birds, if you ever observe them. In any event, the head of a bird, either rooster or hawk, the torso and arms and hands of a man, and this torso and arms are usually very very muscular radiating strength and power. Then he usually has what is sort of the military tunic, that sort of skirt-like short military tunic of the Roman or Greek or Roman soldier, and the legs are snakes, never anything else. Sometimes the snakes look more authentic than at other time, depending on the how good the artist was. But they are always, sometimes they are coiled, sometimes they strike, all kinds of poses, but legs are in snakes. In the arms, almost invariably, the abraxas, in the hands rather, in one hand he holds a shield, and usually on the shield are inscribed the letters IAO, Iota, Alpha, Omega, an important sacred mantric word and name of the ancient Gnostics. In the other hand, he holds almost invariably a whip. I mentioned before that a rather benighted character who wrote a catalogue at one of the antique auction houses and was describing an Abraxas, said the Abraxas is holding a boomerang. Well, you know, the way they depict the whip, it has a handle, and then from the handle you see another part coming. The whip also sometimes looks like the traditional Egyptian flail, which the pharaohs have worn, and which certainly can be used as a whip. However, its original use is to beat the grain so that, like wheat and so forth, that the individual kernels will fall out. We shall see a little bit more about it and about the possible symbolism that is involved. Gentleman who was rather important and influential in studies of this sort, the studies of esoterica here in Los Angeles for a long time, Mr. Manly Palmer Hall, in his posthumously published little book, The Wisdom of the Knowing Ones, which I had the privilege of editing and to which I wrote an introduction, refers to an 18th century book which he obviously had. I hope it's still in the library. If not, I will crow like Abraxas, but in an angry fashion. An 18th century book by a French priest, the Abbé de Montfaucon, entitled Antiquity Explained, which contains several plates on which there are organized, on each one of them, maybe 20 or more different designs of Abraxoids, Gnostic gems. And Mr. Hall writes about this as follows, and I might as well, since we cannot invoke him even with the most powerful Gnostic words of power here right now, I think we'll have to invoke him by way of his writings. God bless him wherever he is. Mr. Hall writes, the French father Montfaucon states that a number of Gnostic gems were excavated in the vicinity of his abbey, which had a collection of more than 60 of these stones. I surmise that his abbey must have been in Egypt. After all, there were particularly French missionaries always in Egypt and scholars. They were widely dispersed, and one came to light recently in the Arabian area. He writes of that one. It had been set into a brass world for a while, like a lion. We are in, you know, in our lower nature, we are anything but good. That was a great big foolishness to think that the human being as he is now is good. Nonsense. And the way is going to change, the way the lion's head is going to change into the head of the bird, is not going to happen just by going to school. It's not going to happen by indoctrination. It's not going to happen by politics. It's not going to happen by becoming rich. It's not going to happen by becoming powerful. It is going to happen by a transformed consciousness. And then all of a sudden, the bloodthirsty lower beauty changes, the wings come, and the spirit flies up to something greater. In the Gospel of Thomas, there is a saying, if they ask you, who are you? Say, we are the children of the living Father. If they ask you where you originated, say, we have come from the light where the light originated through itself. If they ask you what is the sign of your Father within you, say, it is a movement and a rest. When the memory awakens, when we can say in full consciousness that we are the children of the living Father, that we originated in the light where the light originated in itself, then we are no longer Yaldabaoth, but we are Abraxas. And so I think the figure of Abraxas can be our example. We also can hold the shield of wisdom and the whip of the power of the soul. We also can have not only our head in the clouds, but our head above the clouds, our arms and body on the earth, and our roots, those snakes look like roots, you know, in the waters of the unconscious, and thereby unite the lowest with the highest and rise to our highest ability and to our highest potential. So maybe when we look at that strange figure from now on, or when we happen to have one in some reproduction, this would be a nice thing to think about, and might be a fine way in which we can put this ever mysterious figure reproduced 1,800 years ago on stones large and small carved into the stones of Egypt and still among us in various ways to an important and productive spiritual use. And maybe there was a little productive spiritual use in our being together here this evening too. If so, then our efforts have been well rewarded. So I thank you very much for coming, and I hope we'll see you again.
Copyright NMI by DC Recordings, catalog number 100906. For more information about available lecture titles and for many other resources, visit gnosis.org. That's gnosis.org.